Ghost Hunting in New England,
your favorite spooky podcast. Hello and happy Wednesday. Welcome to this week's episode of Ghost Hunting in New England with your hosts, Amelia.
And Beth.
Happy Halloween, Beth.
Happy Halloween, Amelia.
Ooh, spooky, spooky Halloween week. We've made it. Okay, so Beth, what are we talking about today?
Well, we are talking about something very topical. The Conjuring House in Rhode Island. The Perrin family, the Warrens. And all the other people associated with that terrible, terrible event.
Yeah. So tonight we are talking about the very, very, very spooky farmhouse at the top of the road in Harrisville, Rhode Island. Should we just jump on in?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. So way back in a land far, far away, January 1971, the Perrin family moved into this 14-room farmhouse down in Harrisville, Rhode Island, which is like, it's right on the border of Massachusetts. Depending where you are in New England, you can get there pretty easily. So Carolyn and Roger moved into the home with their five daughters. The house was known as the Richard Arnold House and had been in the Arnold family pretty much since it was built back in 1736. So the family, the parents, they move in and they begin to notice all these strange things happening immediately. So the first things that started happening were happening to the mother, Carolyn. So she would notice her broom would go missing. She would notice things of dirt on her floor after she had already swept it, I guess, after she found her broom. And then the children also started hearing little things here and there. So it started really small and it kind of like blew up over time. Then the girls, and so there were five children, all girls, they started noticing spirits in the house. And they thought it was pretty harmless, but then it like, again, it like amped up and there seemed to be like one main spirit. The original Arnold family had been there like 7 or 8 generations. They'd been there a very long time. And there had been some mysterious deaths associated with the family, but given the time period, it being way back in the early 1700s, all the way through the 1800s, 1900s, you could have a mysterious death like pretty easily. Like people were dying. And that was just like across the board. Unfortunately, like some kids did die in the pond or like the creek behind their house. Other people, it was just kind of mysterious. But I don't know if it was any more mysterious than like any other death at that time. So a lot of people think that the spirit was this woman called Bathsheba. And if you guys watch the Conjuring movie, that's the spirit who kind of they really focus on. And so people thought it was her. Andrea Perrin, the oldest of the girls, she is quoted as having said, whoever the spirit was, she perceived herself to be the mistress of the house, and she resented the competition of the mother posed for that position. A lot of people at the time thought it was Bathsheba who was doing that. And there really was a woman, and her name was Bathsheba Sherman, but she never lived in the house. She lived next door to the house at the Sherman property. And she was said to have been a Satanist. There's some controversy around that because she was also buried in a Baptist cemetery. It was said that she may have, that she had sacrificed her son to the devil. But there's another thought that like kind of later as it moved on, they thought maybe it wasn't Bathsheba. They thought maybe it had been Mrs. Arnold, the original woman of the house, because she had been found hanging in her barn back in 1797 at the age of 93. Well, Bathsheba wasn't even born until 1812, and she died in 1885. And she died from paralysis due to a stroke. But not everyone believes that either. So it's a lot of speculation around this. So Andrea Perrin went on to write House of Darkness, House of Light. And the first version of that came out on March 8th, 2011. And it is long. And there are like multiple books she has written on this. And so according to her, the family experienced other spirits in the house and smelled a lot of rotting flesh and caused beds to rise off the floor. She claimed her father would enter the basement and feel cold, stinking presence behind him. And they often stayed away from the dirt floor cellar, but the heating equipment would often fail and it would make Roger have to go down in there and fix it. So he was in the basement a lot. Over the 10 years they lived in the house, they ended up calling the infamous Ed and Lorraine Warren to come and investigate. So at one point, Lorraine conducted a seance to attempt to contact the spirits that were possessing the family. And during the seance, the mother, Carolyn Perron, became possessed. She was speaking in tongues. She was rising up the floor. And Andrea had always said she had kind of like witnessed all this. She had seen everything. It was very like spectacular. After the seance, Roger actually told the Warrens to stay away and that he didn't want them meddling in the house anymore. He was really worried about his wife's sanity at the time. And there was a lot of talk that the Warrens were actually making it worse while they were there. Like they were like kicking up more activity than had previously already happened there. So now the house is owned by Corey and Jennifer Heinzen. And actually earlier this fall, they put it out on the market to sell it. So it's currently listed at $1.2 million. I checked it this morning. It's under contract, so someone's buying it. And I've been there. I went with Paul. And one of the things Corey was talking about while we were down there is something really, really interesting. So I'm going to play this clip from Andrea Perron about something she's going to talk about, and then we will talk about that a little more in depth.
The Perron family settles into their new home. And for the girls, bedtime becomes treacherous.
Cindy walks into my room, and she was shaking. And I asked her what was wrong. She said, "I hear voices all around the bed. They're all talking at once. They're all saying the same thing." "Cindy, what are they saying?" "There are 7 dead soldiers." "There are 7 dead soldiers buried in the wall." She just said it over and over. "There are 7 dead soldiers buried in the wall. There are 7 dead soldiers buried in the wall. There are 7 dead soldiers buried in the wall." And she was terrified. She said she took the pillow and put it over her head to block the sound. And she leapt out of her bed and came to my bed, and she did not understand how we could not possibly hear them.
Spooky. So when I was down there with Paul, we were actually going to the premiere of the 3rd Conjuring movie. They had like an event down there, and we went and we watched the movie In the House. And he was saying while we were there that they did some kind of sonic something on the grounds where like the radar penetrates the grounds kind of, and you can kind of see what's going on. And by one of the brick walls in the back of the house, they seem to find these like, they're like gaps that seem to be 7 graves buried under there, which is wild. But that they couldn't like dig it up because then the house would be like a historic something. You'd have archaeologists come in, and I don't know. I don't know. But so they're not digging it up. I know that. Maybe the new owners will. Who knows? But that's one thing that I thought was very, very, very interesting and really, really cool. Now, obviously, this became a huge, huge franchise. It was the same director who did the Saw series and the Insidious series. Now he's doing the Conjuring series, and it's huge. And it's arguably one of Ed and Lorraine Warren's most well-known cases. And here's what Andrea Perron actually had to say about the movie. So this, again, for those who are kind of in and out now, she actually lived in the house. She was the oldest daughter, and she claims to have seen the seance where her mother began speaking in tongues.
This July, a major motion picture is scheduled to be released worldwide. Amazing. The Conjuring is a story, a true story. You don't hear of that happening, being captured in film frequently. It will say based on a true story, and this film is, but it's unique in that it captures not only our story as the Perrin family, but also tells it from the perspective, a very unique perspective, of Ed and Lorraine Warren, the paranormal researchers who came to our farm, our childhood home, in the early 1970s. They came to help us. This story languished for 30 years, close to 40 years. And in fact, I had the privilege to go to California and see an advanced screening of the film and sat beside Mrs. Warren with my sister Cindy at my side, and we passed a box of tissues back and forth because it touched each one of us in ways that I never thought that it would. I expected something entirely different. I expected Hollywood to do what Hollywood does. And yet, in some ways, this is a very quiet and studious film. You would never know that from the trailers, but that's their job, to entice an audience. It's also about the love of a family. It's also about people who came to help, who felt that this was the most significant and compelling and dark and disturbing story that they had ever heard in the course of a 50-year career. What I can say on behalf of James Wan, the producers, the cast and crew of The Conjuring, is that they truly captured what we endured. You can't cram 10 years into 2 hours, but you can die trying.
So that's what she had to say about it. Some people have said some other stuff, and Beth, you're going to talk about that a little more. I found another clip from Lorraine Warren speaking about it. Lorraine actually passed away a few years ago, but she was able to be interviewed back in 2013 about this for Screen Slam. So here's a little bit about what she had to say about the Perrin house and the Perrin family.
The Perrin house was a very, very old house. Very, very old house. Now, certain families can move into these houses where phenomena has taken place, but it doesn't affect them. Other families can move in and hell breaks loose. I mean, they weren't the kind of people that were opening doors with Ouija boards and doing things like that. They weren't that kind of people. They were living out in the country, and she was there alone a lot with those girls. And so it was sad. That was a very, very sad case. But you realize when things happen, there's laws of attraction. And that family could move out. Another family could move in, nothing happens. I love them, Vera and Pat.
So it's interesting because there's the Perrin version of events, which seems to be what the Conjuring movie was based on. And then there's the other side of the story. You would think in a house that haunted, right, that had that many events take place, that there would have to be other things that happened to the other families that moved in afterwards, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of went digging to see who they were. Well, the next owner, quotes around next owner, right after the parents, who was going to do some renovations to the property, he apparently left screaming in the middle of the night and wouldn't come back even for his clothes. He left his tools. He left everything that he had and just walked away from it. Well, ran away from it. But this was all according to Andrea Perrin. And she is not necessarily recognized as the best authority on having an objective understanding of what happened in that house. So after that, we have Norma and Jerry Sutcliffe. They owned the house from 1987 until they sold it in 2019. They had experienced some opening and closing of the door in the front hall. They heard voices carrying on conversations in other rooms. They would hear footsteps. Chairs and beds would like vibrate underneath them in the house. They were even featured on Ghost Hunters. And the Ghost Hunters seemed to find a bunch of things that the family said that they had never experienced. So they thought that was a little strange. Really, the biggest problem with them that caused them to sell the house was the movie. So they sold the house in 2019 to Jennifer and Corey Heinzen, who Amelia talked about briefly. And Corey and Jennifer have a daughter, Madison. And Madison tells a story of she was sitting in the kitchen eating some dinner by herself when she saw out of the corner of her eye a ghost in a wedding dress run by. And apparently they see a ghost in a wedding dress in the house from time to time. Otherwise, they hear the doors opening and closing. They hear footsteps, knocks on the wall. So there's a lot of stuff that seems to go on in the house, but it also seems like a lot of it could be chalked up to just it's an old house sitting on some old land. So
wait, hold on.
What?
I mean, I have an old house on old land, and I don't see a woman in a wedding dress running around.
Not yet.
No, not yet. But I don't know if that's just how you made it sound was like, well, it's like floorboards creaking, like it's an old house on old land. Like,
well, not... so, you know, doors will kind of creak and they'll open and close, or, you know, it's got steam heat. So it could be just the pipes rattling a little bit, you know, and sometimes that does sound like voices. Right. And especially it might sound a little bit like voices having a conversation just out of hearing.
That would not be why someone would see someone running around in a wedding dress.
Well, no, but it could.
No. And
it could explain a lot of the other things that go on there. But we've all seen stuff like, you know, out of the corner of our eye here and there.
So. Yeah. When I was down there, too, they were talking about believing that it's possible that there are like gray aliens on the property. And Corey seemed to really believe that and showed us some photos on like a little video he had on his phone where it looked like there could be something kind of like peeking out from behind a wall. And
well, speaking of aliens, apparently Andrea Perrin has been telling people in the last few years that aliens and UFO have been communicating with her since she was about 12 years old.
Hey, there you go.
So who knows? Maybe
it's a little connection.
All right. Anyway, so as I said, Norma and Jerry Sutcliffe were very impacted by the movie. But they were impacted in a way that it just made their life terrible, right? They were constantly being harassed by trespassers and people who just thought it was okay to show up at their property and show up at their house and, you know, feel like they deserve to be let in because they saw this thing in a movie, right? They were really bombarded with requests from ghost hunters and paranormal investigators to come in. And they're like, yeah, no, we don't want you people in our house. So Norma has spent a tremendous amount of time going out and researching a lot of the claims made by the Perrin family. And she has even put together, there's information that you can find on websites. There's lots of stuff. She has a slideshow that she has put together and a talk that she gives on YouTube. It's about an hour long. And she goes through a great number of the things that the Perrin family talked about. And she, you know, tells you how she was able to research them and what her findings were. So welcome to my summary of her research. So the Perrins claimed many deaths from the Arnold family being that long lasting 7 or 8 generation family that owned the home. Right. They claimed that there were 2 self-hangings, right? Bathsheba, John Arnold, and Susan Arnold, John Arnold's wife. And I know that that's 3 names. And the Perrins claimed 2 hangings. But the Perrins also claimed that 1 person was poisoned, that they poisoned themselves to commit suicide. I couldn't find a name on that. They also claimed that there was 1 child raped and murdered That was Prudence Arnold. There were two drownings, the Baker boys, a father and son duo, and that four people froze to death on the property. Among them, Edwin Arnold and Jarvis Smith. So Norma Sutcliffe goes out and she finds what's called the Black Book. Have you heard about the Black Book?
No, what's that?
So this is an actual book. It is the register of all the unusual deaths in Harrisville from 1806 until sometime in the 1950s.
Ooh.
Right. So that's, I assume that like all little towns probably had something similar to this. So she made it her mission.
So yeah, little towns keep like very, very detailed notes on everything going on there.
Oh yeah. Cause everybody knows everybody and they know everybody's business and it's you know, all recorded.
Yeah.
So Norma sets out to investigate all of these claims. So starting right from the top, right, we have Bathsheba, who, according to the Perrins and the Conjuring movie, was some sort of terrible she-witch who was, you know, a Satan worshiper who killed her own child with a sewing needle, right? And then she may have been responsible for the death of another child. Everybody in town knew she did it, but they couldn't prove it. So they brought her into court and accused her, but she wasn't convicted of anything. And then she got to go home and live out her life. And according to the parents, hung herself in the barn, right? So the real story of Bathsheba, Amelia alluded to earlier, she didn't even live in the house. She lived in the property next door. She was married to a man named Judson Sherman. There were no records of her killing a child or even being accused of killing any children. And in a small town that keeps such great records of all of these unusual deaths, don't you think they would have kept a record of the unusual death of children in the house?
Yeah.
Especially maybe, you know, by knitting needle to the brain. Like it's crazy. She did have four children, right? So there was this idea that it was just that one infant that she sacrificed, that that was her only child. No, she had four children. Three of them actually did not live into adulthood, but they died as young children, but not as babies, 2, 3, 5 years old, I think. But then she had one child, Herbert, her third child, I believe, who actually lived to adulthood. He was like 70 or so when he died. And again, she did not hang herself in anyone's barn. She died in her own home, not in the parents' home, of a stroke, May 25th, 1885. So number one, death in the house, disproven by all the records that are readily available to anyone who wants to go to town hall and look at them. All right, next up, John Arnold, who was supposedly one of the original owners. According to the parents, he also hung himself somewhere in the parent house. He did not hang himself in the barn, but it was actually in the house. No, not true at all. He actually owned a property across town, and he was in that property across town when he died.
Oh.
Okay. So then we have Mrs. Arnold, right? And that's all that it was referred to by the parents as Mrs. Arnold. So Norma Sutcliffe went through all of the records pertaining to anyone who could be referred to as Mrs. Arnold and was able to come up with Susan Arnold, right? This is not the same Mrs. Arnold who was 93 years old or something when she hung herself, who, according to the parents, is what happened. This instead was the wife of John Arnold, and she was 50 when she did hang herself. She hung herself in a barn, but it was across town. In that other property where her husband died. So not on the property here. Okay. Then we have Prudence Arnold. Now, this is the 11-year-old girl who was raped and murdered in the house. Prudence Arnold was not in any way related to the Arnolds of the house there in Harrisville. Okay. They went back like 7 or 8 generations to see that like this, there's no relatives in common here. She never lived in that house. Nobody knows if she was even ever in that house, like ever in her whole life. Carolyn said that Prudence was murdered in the pantry of the house there. Actually, she was murdered about 9 miles away in Uxbridge, Massachusetts. And it was a pretty big story, and it was pretty well documented. So there is no report of the child being raped at her death. It was only actually added years and years later, sensationalized in a story that somebody wrote, and then it was repeated by Andrea Perrin. This young child, who supposedly, according to the parents, died in their house. Nope, didn't die the way they said that she died. So it's one of those really sad stories of unrequited love.
Aww.
So she's 11, right? And she's living over in this place in Uxbridge, Massachusetts. And this 22-year-old suitor, you know, has been coming. This is the 1800s, Amelia. Stop making that face. This would not have been unusual.
No, 11's weird.
It would not have been unusual. Okay. It would be very unusual now if you're 22 and pursuing an 11-year-old. Stop immediately. Also, if you're 11 and this is 22.
In the 1800s, that would still be weird. That's like 1500s stuff.
You wouldn't have been married at 11, but you would have been betrothed. Like, you could have said, like, this is going to be your husband when you grow up, like, because they want the money that he's making in his 20s. Anyway, so she refused to consent to marry the 22-year-old suitor, and he was so upset about it, he slit her throat. And then he, like, walks over into the next room a little overcome about what he'd done and killed himself. So that all happened nowhere near the parents' house. Anyway, then we have the Baker boys, who were that father-son duo that you had mentioned drowned in a creek. So again, we have this black book of all of these unusual, mysterious, suspicious, however you want to write it, deaths that occurred, you know, from the early 1800s forward. There's no mention anywhere in any of the black book of any suspicious or unusual deaths taking place on the Perrin property or what was the property before the parents owned it. So all of these ghosts, they don't seem to actually be connected to that property. That's the research that Nora did. But some of the other things that she really talks a lot about are the movie company, right? Warner Brothers, New Line Cinema, whoever made the movie, actually didn't tell her or her husband that the name of the town was going to be published and that people were going to, like, start flocking to the place.
Yeah, that's a problem.
According to her, they also didn't warn the local police that this was going to be happening. So there was this sudden massive influx of just, you know, people who wanted to see where the story happened, right? And you don't blame people for being curious, but you blame people for being obnoxious and not understanding that, like, this is someone's home. Like, be respectful. Right. You don't just get to, like, walk all over the property or anything like that. And, you know, don't even park on their front lawn. Like, just be a person. Right. So she has actually completed, I mentioned earlier, the extensive research about the history and the property just to disprove the Perrin family's claims and to get all of these people away from her property. But it didn't seem to work. And she ultimately had to sell it. The last thing that I want to share from her is there's supposedly when the Perrin family bought the house in the early 70s, the man that they bought it from, when he turned the keys over to Roger Perrin, the father, had said, you know, for the sake of your children, leave the lights on at night. Right. And this has been interpreted some really ominous warning. You know, the family should have known there was a problem, blah, 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 blah. According to Norma, it's actually nowhere near sinister. And it was actually like a really friendly sort of thing. Like, it's a big house. You got little kids, like, turn the light on so they can find the bathroom in the middle of the night. You know, which I think actually makes a lot of sense. Like, that would be that's like the sort of advice you give the next people who are going to move into your house. Like, it's very useful, but completely impersonal advice.
It's dark out there. It's dark out there. It's a huge property and it's very dark. And it's very rural.
I imagine it was probably terrifying just to be there at night, like, without anything spooky going
on. Yeah.
I found this quote on skepticalinquirer.com, and I thought that this just kind of summed up everything that I had, you know, kind of found in my research. So Amelia was tasked with finding the Perrin family story and the movie, and I got the how to pick it apart and what's the controversy surrounding it. So I feel like this quote really wraps up everything that I had to say. In the end, The Harrisville farmhouse simply doesn't have the tragic and gruesome history we've been led to believe. When legitimate research is done by competent people, we find that the tragedies used to justify the hauntings of the farmhouse have been snatched away from other families of the area.
Wow.
All right, like that's some serious shade. So that's my story.
Cool. Pretty good. And so, yeah, that's great, Beth. Thank you. And then, of course, as like everyone kind of knows, the Warrens themselves are very controversial. But you don't really want to get too much into why the Warrens are super controversial when you're a paranormal podcast in New England. So if you guys want to look into that on your own, you can go right ahead. That's all we're going to say about that. Yeah, that's the story.
Yeah, it's crazy. And what's really interesting about it is that they only had these experiences in this house, right? And they were the only ones having the experience in this house. Nobody else had the experiences after them. And even after the Perrin family moved on, they didn't have any experiences after that.
Well, Corey and Jennifer have experiences.
Well, Norma said that she had, you know, a few things happened here and there, but nothing really.
No one was like levitating.
Yeah,
no one's been talking in tongues.
No.
No
conjuring level stuff. Absolutely not.
Beth, you watched the movie for the first time today. How'd you like it?
I did. I actually liked it a lot. I thought it was going to be kind of, I thought it was going to be kitschy and, you know, really like a slasher movie from the 80s sort of thing, but it was not. It was well done. And there were a few instances where I actually jumped. They got me with a couple of good jump scares. And I sent a message to Amelia at one point that, you know, this is terrifying. I'm really glad that I didn't go to that house with her and Paul when they went last summer.
It's spooky. It's a spooky house. When they show photos back from the 70s when all this was happening, it's like, you know, like white paneling on the side of the house. And now the house looks old now. It looks a lot older than 1970s. I don't know who did it or when they did it, but it looks like a old house.
They resided it with like brown shingles, so it looks much more rustic.
But even the interior, like it looks like you could step in there and think you were in like the 1700s, 1800s, except for the kitchen. Yeah, the whole thing looks very old. But yeah, so that's our story.
It's a good story.
It is a good story. Yeah, it's a great story. So Beth and I have exciting news. Something exciting happened to us this week.
Very exciting.
We got in the Boston Globe.
Yeah, we did. Yay, us.
That was very exciting. Very unexpected. Wow. Mm-hmm. Wowie wow. But cool.
You know, it's funny. I was looking at it again this morning and I noticed that neither of our names are mentioned, but Tim's is.
I know. I thought that too. I was like, what the heck? Everyone loves Tim.
But Tim's when you like saw the other podcasts, show. You know, it like has the host's names right in the article.
I know. He somehow Tim outshone us.
Yeah, somehow. Yeah, Tim Regan. He's the star of our show. we love Tim. He really is the star of our show. But
yeah,
he's still one
funny.
Of the hosts. So it was all that he was not.
No, it's not.
We love you, Tim. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. And then we went to the Alden House and we went out to dinner at the Sun Tavern. And that was very nice. There's some haunted happenings we went to this week.
Well, the Alden House, what was really fun about that, you know, Amelia talked about that she got us tickets to go to this tour, right? When we did historical haunted homes of the South Shore. Mm-hmm. And so we get there and there's a ton of people.
We were going on an informational tour of this historic haunted house.
Right. And we thought it was going to be like
haunted. We'll tell you
people.
We'll tell you like some spooky stories. We'll like show you like the history of the house. That's not what it was.
No, not at all. It was a haunted house. Like you went through
like
a little tour group and our guide could not have looked more bored if he tried.
No, it was like an eighth grade.
He was way too cool to be there. You go through the whole, you know, first floor of the house and, you know, there's the people that jump out and grab you. Like it was that kind of haunted house. And so then you come out
except
and
Except it's like, it's a small house and it was cool being in the house, like looking around the house, but it's not huge.
No.
And it was probably like, if you had had a haunted house in that house and you had like four people jump out at you, that would have been a really good haunted house. But there were like 50 people jumping out at you, or at least it felt that way. No, probably maybe close to like 15. And like, I felt very like claustrophobic. And I know no one wants to hear this. I know no one wants to hear about the pandemic. I get that. I am still very nervous about the pandemic. And even though I take very good care, and I don't like being in small spaces with a lot of people when there's not a pandemic. But then like, I don't know. I was very jumpy.
She literally walked around the whole time and said, "Don't touch me. Don't touch me. Don't touch me." Yep.
I said, "You can jump out at me, but you cannot touch me. You can jump out at me, but you cannot touch me." And Paul has been making fun of me endlessly since we did that.
They're not allowed to touch you anyway. That's the thing.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, that's a big rule. Well, I didn't
want some kid to like come out and like hit me with like their fake chainsaw, like lightly, and me freak out and punch them. You know, like
that's
I didn't
why
want...
they're not allowed to touch you.
Great. And they didn't. And that was really nice.
You're not allowed to touch them either.
Absolutely not. I wouldn't want to. Ooh. And then we got fake tattoos from the Girl Scout troop.
Yep. Mine was a kitty. Cool. It said meow. They had a tarot card reader and they had a spooky walk. So this was actually really funny. We go down the spooky path, right? And so it's, you know, Sean, my husband, and Amelia and her husband, Paul. And so we're going down the path and, you know, they have all these little candles and bags along the side, which by the way, was a wicked fire hazard, but let's not focus on that right now. And they have people like jumping out of the woods at you to scare you, you know? So we have Amelia's refrain of, "Please don't touch me. Please don't touch me. Please don't touch me." And we get all the way to the end. Right. And it lets you out on the field at Duxbury High School, the football field. And so there was another path that we had seen leaving the house. And we're like, "Oh, well, this one must just wrap around and meet up with that other one." So there we are, us four dopes. We're out walking along the football field. It's like 8 o'clock at night. There's no lights. There's no nothing. And we get like halfway down the football field. And we're like, "Yeah, I don't think it connects with the other side." We had to walk all the way back. Like, it was just so odd that as you would like come out at the end, there's like no like, "This is the end, go back." There's nobody there. Like, it was just like, "And out you go into this crazy football field. I hope there's no axe murderers."
Yeah, it was super spooky.
It was very funny. And they had a little maze that you could walk through. And in one of the little corners of the maze, they were sacrificing a hot dog. Amelia asked me what they were doing down there. So I just had to make up the most ridiculous thing I had ever thought I could ever think of. And so she went down to investigate.
Yeah, but it was fun.
Yeah. And then we went to the Sun Tavern and had dinner and we were all very hungry. Yeah. And our waitress, and Bailey, was very nice and very chatty. But she has not seen the ghost. She doesn't even believe that there are ghosts at the Sun Tavern because nobody's been pushed down the stairs. And I did some thinking about that. And I don't know why people think that ghosts have to be violent, because most of them aren't.
It's true.
Right. Occasionally you get a scary one that yells at you.
But we had fun.
We did. We had great fun.
Yeah, it was a great time.
And Sean even got home in time to close up the store.
Nice.
Yeah, it was very nice. So Amelia and I hope that you guys enjoyed the bonus episode this week as well.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. So do you want to hear about our reviews from this week?
We have reviews.
Our first review comes to us from Facebook. This comes from Nathan. "You guys just honestly rock."
Thanks, Nathan. Thanks for not lying to us about it.
"I've been listening to your podcast for 2 years now. I'm a long haul truck driver and I think I've listened to it, all of it, way more than 4 times. LOL. Great rehash of history of hauntings and paranormal events/entities. Great insights. Awesome interviews. Ghost hunting in New England has it all. Both of your personalities just shine through, and you've carried me on many long journeys. It is greatly appreciated. Thanks so much, and keep going." And I got to tell you, that just made me beam ear to ear when I saw that. That was great.
Yeah, thanks, Nathan. And thanks for all of your long hours sitting in a truck driving stuff back and forth so that I can have avocados or whatever it is I want out of season. So we appreciate you. So thank you so much.
I appreciate truckers like now more than ever with all these like food chain shortages.
Mm-hmm.
So our next 5-star review comes to us from Dave in Shelby, North Carolina. Found this podcast 2 weeks ago and have been binge listening as much as I can, trying to catch up. Love listening to you two. Very entertaining. And I love a good ghost story. Beth and Amelia are wonderful to listen to and have amazing chemistry. Looking forward to the next episode. Well, thank you so much, Dave in Shelby, North Carolina. That is so nice.
Thanks, Dave.
Yeah, very encouraging.
Do you remember way back in season one, we got an email from somebody that was like, do you two even like each other?
Yes.
I still laugh about that email sometimes.
So we have a review that came to us on Audible as well. And I feel like this is really good that we got these reviews on all three of our major review sites at like our last episode. That way you can know all the places you can leave us reviews.
Yay!
Yay! So this review is, oh my ghost, William and the Haunted Dolls. 5-star overall, 5-star performance, and 5-star story. These three are so funny. I love when Will joins you, and I will not lie. I keep praying he doesn't get any real haunted dolls. That's right, folks. If you've never listened before, the banter is totally entertaining. Again, you're nuts, Will. Ha ha ha. I live on the other side of the country, and these ladies have me wanting to take a road trip out to check out New England's spookiest spots. So much fun to listen to, y'all. Well, thank you so much. This person didn't leave their name.
Thank you, anonymous Audible listener. We appreciate your patronage.
That was great. So yeah, everyone, please leave us a 5-star review. You can find our review sites on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, or Audible.
You can also just email us a review direct to ghosthuntinginnewengland@gmail.com. Give it as many stars as you want, or you can even come up with your own rating system and we'll read it there.
Yeah. Well, this has been a really great season, Beth. I think we've done a lot of fun stuff.
We have. This was a very exciting season.
Very exciting.
And I know that we have lots of ideas for next season too.
We do. Yeah. So we will definitely see you all in the spring. Mm-hmm. That would be great. Do you have anything else you want to talk about, Beth?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. So this week coming up, I have two short things. The first is this week coming up at some point, I will be on my friend Josh's podcast. That is The Steam Gentleman. So you can catch me there this coming week. And in between our seasons, I'll be doing a podcast with the medium Jamie Day called Lost Souls of America Podcast. So if you miss hearing my voice in between, you can check me on Lost Souls of America podcast. I'm kind of like the cute sidekick, though. Like Jamie does most of the talking.
And if you miss my voice, you can just replay Ghost Hunting in New England seasons 1, 3, 4, and 5. Woohoo! Although if you ask very nicely, maybe I'll send you a recorded message for your birthday.
What's that? Cameo? We should get on Cameo.
I wouldn't charge people for it, though. I would totally sing people happy birthday.
Go shorty, it's your birthday.
No, I'd sing the classic song. I'd just do it off key and I'd change one or two words so I wasn't sued.
Well, anyway, Beth, thank you so much. This was a great, 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 great season. I think we had so much fun and a great time.
Agreed. Thanks for all your hard work.
You too. And to all of our listeners, you can find us online at ghosthuntinginnewengland.com, facebook.com/ghosthuntinginnewengland, on Twitter at ghosthuntingne, or on Instagram at ghosthuntinginnewengland. Send us a drive-by ghosting at ghosthuntinginnewengland@gmail.com, and we look forward to seeing you all in the spring.
And when you're in a restaurant, if the person next to you at the other table needs reading glasses to read the menu, just let them use yours. That's an okay thing to do.
And as always,
happy hunting.